Howdy, everybody, and welcome to another BP Movie Journal, the show we do where we talk about the stuff we've seen since the last time we did one of these. I'm David.
I'm Tyler. You went a little Casey Kasem there, which I appreciate.
Yeah. That's a good... I'm obsessed, as most people are, with the, like, you know, the tirades caught on.
Oh, of course.
His is a really good one.
Yeah. Goddamn death dedication. But he's still, that's the other thing. A tirade is one thing. A tirade in a, like Orson Welles, of course, has like that wonderful voice, and Casey Kasem has that iconic voice, and to hear him, and then you realize, like, oh no, that's just his voice.
Right.
But there's still a certain cadence, and it's just like, it's not so strange to hear him angry. It feels fake.
Yeah.
But we do have a number of
movies to talk about.
And it occurred to me there might be some overlap.
Like there's at least one overlap for sure.
Yeah.
Yes. That might be the only one, though.
Yeah.
Although my first movie that I'm going to talk about is a movie that I know you've seen.
Okay.
And I have said the name of this movie out loud exactly once in my life, and it didn't feel good. So get ready for the second time ever of me saying the name of this movie out loud. Hopefully it'll be the last.
Okay.
Even though I love the movie. I watched Justin Chan's Gook.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. That's it. I said it.
Yeah, there
I'm
it is.
I'm done having said the name of that
movie. It was like one of my favorite movies that year. I'm like, damn it.
Yeah. Yeah. But the reason I watched it, you can read my Someone We Watched column over at Film Independent. Mm. I talked about that. And his newest movie, Blue Bayou, which I think both movies are terrific. I don't think I saw Blue Bayou first.
Yeah.
And then I went back and watched this movie, his first movie. Or actually, it isn't his first, is it? It's the one that got him. But he made something called, like, Man on the Run or something.
Oh, I don't remember, actually.
I think it's actually his second feature. But it's the one that made his name, sort of, as a director. Mm-hmm. All I knew about this movie from 2017 was, like, I knew the general story that took place on the day of the rioting after the verdict of the Rodney King verdict was read, April of 1992, in South Los Angeles. Although it's actually, I realized it's not in South Los Angeles, it's in Paramount, which is a neighboring city. It's
there's so many little there's a Commerce.
Yeah.
And it's like, that seems like a weird name for, is it a city or is it like officially
Paramount
a city?
Paramount is a city.
Paramount is a city. Okay.
Yes. But it's where, whereas South LA, what they don't call South Central anymore officially, I think, because
there's an association.
The term South Central got associated with like gangs and gang violence and stuff like that. So now it's just South Los Angeles. But I think people still say South Central.
Probably, yeah.
But officially, it's just called South Los Angeles. But it's neighboring that. So it's a place that near where the rioting was, but not, I didn't realize that when that was interesting, but I guess I knew that this was semi autobiographical that Justin Chan actually did work at a shoe store in Paramount that his father owned. And so I knew it was black and white. I knew it was semi-autobiographical. I knew this was a guy who was an actor first who went to movies. I had an idea of what this movie was going to be.
Yeah.
That it's not at all.
Yeah.
What I talked about this in the Film Independent piece. As soon as I was done watching it, after having watched Blue Bayou just a few days before, I got on IMDb and I was like, are you sure this guy never directed like a music video? Because he has these impulses for like coming up with these visual moments that like tie into what's going on, but also just sort of work as sublime moments on their own that lift out of the movie. There's a scene where the girl, there's a girl who like a neighborhood girl who like hangs out. You've seen the movie, who hangs out at their shoe store. And there's a scene where she's just dancing in the parking lot while he's doing donuts in his car around her. Yeah. And the title of the movie, a racial slur, is spray painted on the hood of the car.
Yeah.
It's such a striking image in this beautiful black and white with the like whatever you'd call it, the squealing tires and the steam smoke coming off of the tires and this girl like dancing. It's so cool. It doesn't like, it's the kind of thing when I talk about when like, when someone talks about a movie, like, or a scene in a movie, like, oh, they didn't need that. They didn't need to do.
Sure.
That. There is no narrative need for that sequence, right. But it's so cool and also represents this mix of like youthful freedom, but also this fury at lack of options.
Yeah.
All at the same time. And there are a number of moments like that. There's, you know, the slow motion, someone throwing a Molotov cocktail in the movie. Mm-hmm. And by the Blue Bayou, which is in very much in color, has all of this kind of stuff too, but we're not talking about Blue Bayou. We're talking about the movie from 2017,
yeah.
That Justin Tong directed and starred in. I was really blown away. I think this guy's a fantastic talent, and now I want to see Ms. Purple is the one he made in between this and Blue Bayou that I didn't see, and I guess the one he made before. And I'm fascinated to see what else he's done. I, as an actor...
Yeah, and he also plays the lead role. I don't remember if you
mentioned that. Yeah, I did say that.
Okay.
I think I said that. He also plays the lead in Blue Bayou. As an actor, I think he's best known for the Twilight movies, but I didn't see any of them. I saw him in Wayne Wang's Coming Home Again in 2019, and he's fantastic in that as well. So yeah, big. I'm a big fan all of a sudden, I guess, of Justin Chong. Next up, I watched. It was supposed to be a kickoff. I watched it on October 1st. It was supposed to be a kickoff to October, to like horror movies. It's not a scary movie at all. Okay. I mean, it has zombie-like creatures in it.
Okay.
I don't want to get under the skin of the like the zombie crowd who's like, no, they're only zombies if they die and come back to life. So, right. Like 28 days later, not a zombie movie because they're infected or whatever. Anyway, you know the tropes.
Yeah.
So have you seen 1984's Night of the Comet, directed by Tom Eberhardt?
No, I haven't.
So it's a movie in which takes place in Los Angeles, 1984. There's a once a every like tens of millions of years comet is going to pass by. The Earth is actually going to pass through the comet's tail, and so everyone's hosting these like comet watch parties or whatever. And the comet ends up like incinerating and killing every like living thing on the planet, except for a few people who happen to be like behind a steel wall, or like there's a handful of survivors, and then there's a handful of other people who like didn't die, and they're the zombies.
Right.
So, basically you've got some like survivors. Of course, they're like, it's, you know, very mid 80s LA. They're like young, hip and hot people who survived, fighting off, not zombies, but zombie-ish type people. And then there's this whole other plot where there's this like underground research facility, and the scientists are trying to like figure out what's going on, but the scientists might not be great themselves. You know, I think as the movie goes on, it unfortunately loses steam, and just feels like it has to hit the marks of like, okay, and now they're gonna get captured by the scientists,
right.
This guy's gonna like, but the early part, like the early like what we now, the term we now use of like world building, is a lot of fun and strangely funny too. The movie has a great sense of humor, especially in the early going. Like there's, because when the comet turns everyone to dust, and so as they're walking around through Los Angeles, a beautifully empty mid-80s downtown Los Angeles is great, there will sometimes be these little like tableau of like oh, I guess that's what these people were doing at the moment they died. And it's like, it's funny, but it's also horrifying with this empty clothes and like dust on the ground. There's some funny lines early on, but I can't go too much into it. It's it has a lot of promise early on that it doesn't, I think, fulfill. And it's also just not scary
enough to recommend, would you say?
No,
not quite.
I would say not quite. Yeah.
Okay.
There's one part with like a zombie, not zombie kid. That's pretty cool, but yeah, not quite. What did you watch?
I think this will be our bit of overlap here.
Oh, that's good, because it's also my next movie. So we'll just go right into.
All right. Many Saints of Newark.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you go first. It's your movie.
Oh, okay. I thought it was fine at best. Some good performances. Of course, it's like it's a serviceable mob movie. With I think Alessandro Nivola does a really great job. I really enjoy Corey Stoll, but of course, with a performance like his, along with many others, your enjoyment of it is rooted in your knowledge of the character. And I think Corey Stoll, you 100% buy him as a young junior soprano.
Yeah.
Just the cadence, movement, the whole thing. So there's good stuff in it, and there are good sequences in it. But for the most part, it's the most regrettable thing about it is that it's connected to The Sopranos, which is a work of genius, and this is a work of fine.
I think I get what you're coming from, and I'm not going to sit here and say it's great, but I liked it more than most people seem to have.
Mm.
I think because I saw more of not just the there's a lot of like fan service and Easter eggs and like references, but then it also like got me questioning like, well, if this person's around, where's Larry Boy Barisi? Where's Jimmy Altieri? Where's Ray Curto? You know, but I have to realize that most people who even like The Sopranos don't know it as well as I do. Yeah. I haven't watched it multiple times in its entirety, but it's not there. So there's a lot of like references.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also a lot more of the DNA of The Sopranos than people are giving it credit for. I think, especially in the scenes, I don't know how much we can spoil because I didn't know this going in, so I won't, but I'm going to spoil it in our main episode this weekend.
Okay. Yes, absolutely.
But,
yeah.
For those who don't want to be spoiled, Dickie, Alessandro Nivola, there's a relative of his that he visits in prison in multiple points in the movie. Those scenes are my favorite.
Those are the best scenes.
Because it has that Sopranos mix of like someone, because this character who is like a former mob guy who is serving a life sentence and has become a Buddhist, but it isn't like, he isn't like a corny guy, like in robes, like sitting cross-legged or whatever.
Yeah.
He's still the Jersey mob guy.
Yeah.
But he's also just a Buddhist at the same time. And the idea of someone like Dickie, or like any character in Sopranos, coming from a type of American life that is reflexively opposed to self-examination, coming up against these ideas that never would have occurred to him, that's so Sopranos to me. And it's not just Tony goes to therapy. That's the jumping off point. But it happens repeatedly in The Sopranos. People coming up against philosophical ideas, spiritual ideas, and that stuff, and not really knowing what to do with it. Maybe absorbing it a little bit, but you don't see characters in The Sopranos change that much. That's kind of the point. And I think that's what happens. There's also a scene that I think Natalie and I were not quite sure about, so I don't know. He tells this character, Dickie Moltisanti tells this character that he's like looking to atone for certain sins, and he's like, "What have you done?" And he says that he's coaching like a youth baseball team.
Right.
It's more specific than that, but I won't go into it. Do you think that's true? Because I don't. I saw that as like the scene, the montage we see of him coaching. I see that as the idea in his head.
That feels like a Sopranos dream sequence because it's all so perfect.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The way he's championed at the end, it feels like a way a character wishes people saw him.
But also I think the Sopranos thing of it is that I think to Dickie, imagining himself doing that is as... It's as much as he needs.
Yeah.
He'll let himself off the hook for imagining, I could coach a youth baseball team or whatever. Yeah. And that will make him feel better. And that's very Sopranos. I also think the movie is funnier than people are giving it credit for, in that Sopranos way of like, just like there's a scene that takes place at like a confirmation, like reception where like an eighth grade girl has just been confirmed and like an older relative just coming up to her and saying the name you picked, the saint you picked, Apollonia, is the patron saint of dentists.
Yes.
No one, she doesn't know what to do with that information. That's very funny. Very Sopranos. I think Vera Farmiga is great and also funny, but also heartbreaking in one scene.
Yes.
She has a great,
it's enough great that scene. I just wish it was just about her, you know?
Yeah.
I guess and her scenes with, is it Michael Gandolfini?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think those, and then the ones that you're talking about in the prison, I think those are the scenes that are the most electric, because it's all about stuff that isn't said. That's just like, that passes between characters, like the relative in jail, because of his unique situation and that he is not really a part of this anymore and has adopted a philosophy, like his ability to see through Dickie is pretty amazing, but he's not yet to the point, just because he is a Buddhist doesn't mean he can necessarily articulate the beliefs or the philosophy. Yeah, yeah. He's still, like you said, he's still the mob guy.
Yeah.
And, but, yeah, but you can tell
he has like, says something insightful and then he says, what do I know? I'm a murderer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that performance really helps. I do think that like the performances all around really elevate the material. And in certain scenes, the performances like are transportive. It made me think of the Sopranos, not merely because of like, oh, that's a good impression, because I don't think Vera Farmiga's Livia Soprano, I don't think it's like a spot on like, oh yes, that's a one-to-one. It evokes her as it should. She's much younger. It evokes her while also creating a character in and of herself. And so I thought she was, I've always liked Vera Farmiga, but yeah, I think she's definitely the highlight of the film.
There are a couple things in the movie that I think fan service wise, now I'll pivot to what I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's one more thing I'll say that I did like. To anyone out there saying that John Magaro is like over the top, is your contention that Little Steven's performance on The Sopranos was nuanced? Like, he's doing Cilio. Like, yeah. Cilio was a ridiculous character on The Sopranos. He's a ridiculous character on The Many Saints of Newark. It's fine. Okay, so pivoting to the stuff I don't like, there were a couple things that I don't know if I should spoil. There are a couple things that were just like, oh yeah, they talked about that on the show, and we see it happen. Right. I don't think we needed to see what Uncle Junior says to the girl cousins, or the thing when Livia has the beehive hairdo in the car. I guess Sopranos fans will know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
We didn't need to see that. The number one complaint I have about this movie, that I hate it because it's so unnecessary, too much fucking goddamn CGI.
Okay.
There's multiple like fires that are clearly fake.
Yeah. Oh yes.
There's also a guy gets like half his head blown off and it's like very fake looking. Mm-hmm. And then the worst one, there's a part where a guy gets like they're at a auto mechanic shop and you know, one of those like guns that takes the like nuts off of a tire or whatever. Like a guy shoves it in the guy's mouth and like presses it and like
teeth and blood go everywhere. Hypothetically.
But that's the thing. You're like having this reaction right now. Me saying it like, oh my God, that's the reaction I should be having.
Right.
And I would have had if they had just like kept it out of frame and had like blood and tea spewing into frame instead of this fucking like itchy and scratchy shit of like fake CGI blood and teeth going everywhere. Yeah. It looks so stupid that you didn't have to show it. It would have been more effective just not showing it.
Yeah.
It made me like mad.
Yeah. And the thing, like, if you are going to show it, like, I understand, like, my reaction was to simply putting it in his mouth.
Right.
Because you can imagine like, bad things are coming, and then and then it happens. Like, yeah, okay, fine, but it does feel a little over the top. And I'm fine with them showing it. I just don't like what they did with it. I think sort of underplaying it and just like imagine if it didn't go flying everywhere, but instead the guy just winds up with a mouthful of blood and teeth.
Right.
Like, imagine how horrifying that would be.
There's different ways you could do it than just show cartoon teeth, which is what it looked like to me.
Yeah.
All of that just took me out. Anyway, we spent a lot of time on Many Scenes of New Work, but
it's the only bit of overlap, so it's fine.
And Natalie disagrees with me on this, but I feel like it's Sopranos enough that it now needs to become part of a rewatch. That if you're going to rewatch The Sopranos, you should watch.
Would you watch it before season one or after the whole thing?
After the whole thing.
Okay.
Yeah. Although now, because Natalie and I are, as always, rewatching The Sopranos, so we watched the episode after, in season two, the episode after Christopher gets shot when he's in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And his mother comes to visit him, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I just saw her. And he's, like, talking about, like, seeing a vision of his dad when he was, like, in the coma. And I'm like, oh, I've seen this episode a half dozen times before. Now I'm picturing Alessandro Nivola. I wasn't doing that before. That's kind of fun, I guess.
And I do think, I mean, obviously the idea of narrating from the grave, which I don't think that's a spoiler. It's the first moment of the film.
Yeah. I forgot. I didn't like that either.
I didn't necessarily like it, but I actually like the way it was introduced. Like as we're going through the graveyard, the idea that everybody is narrating their own story and we arrive at Christopher. I think that's a really neat idea.
Also rewatching that same episode, From Where to Eternity is what it's called. Because one of the weird things in watching Many Saints of Newark is that, like, oh, I always thought Big Pussy was, like, Tony's age, not closer to Polly and Syl's age. But he's, like, older. But then watching From Where to Eternity, in which Tony and Pussy kill somebody at the end of that episode, and then they, like, go out for a steak, and Tony talks about, he says, like, remember, you brought me here after my first one, or whatever. So, like, I guess it was established that Pussy was something of an elder to Tony.
I think that I never quite realized until watching this that, like, I mean, I knew that the other guys that, like, Polly and Sylvia, like, I knew they were older than Tony. I don't think I realized that they were meant to be that much older than him, like easily 10 to 15 years.
Easily, yeah.
I don't think I realized that.
Yeah, well, because Tony's also younger than we think. Because
yes, that's true. It's like when you realize that, like, Homer Simpson is officially, like, 38 and a half. I'm like, shit, I'm older than Homer Simpson.
Yeah, me too. Okay, I could do an entire podcast just talking about stuff in Many Scenes of Newark that relates to talk about, like, oh, I don't know how much I can say.
Just say it.
Because I don't know if people were avoiding spoilers, but on this podcast, I talked about how one thing I hoped we saw was young Artie Bucco, and we got Artie Bucco at two different ages.
Yeah, we did. It's but we don't see him as the little player.
No, but he is like.
But he's there.
He's in when the younger of him is like with Tony getting involved in like.
Yeah.
Shenanigans like at school, you know, mob junior type shenanigans at school. That's fun. And then he and then we see Jackie April. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I would have loved to see a young Tony B, but I want him to be played by Steve Buscemi. And he says, greetings, fellow.
Kids. Right. Yeah. Yeah. There is a reference to Tony.
They do reference him. Yes.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen more, and I understand why it's not the story they're telling, but I would have liked to have seen Rosalie April or Angie Bonpensero, now I'm forgetting Silvio's wife's name, but I can picture. I always like those characters on the Sopranos. When Natalie and I went to Paris in 2019, we did multiple things that Carmen Rowe did when they went to Paris. not all of them. We didn't go to like the tackier shit.
Right, of course.
All right, let's move on. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that was too long.
So next is yours.
Next is a new documentary that hasn't come out yet called Flee, F-L-E-E, directed by Jonas Poher Rasmussen. And I guess kind of the less you know about it, the better, because it's basically he made this documentary about one of his best friends that he's known since he was 15, who is an Afghan refugee who moved to Denmark. Is that another movie? No, I'm forgetting. Yes, Copenhagen. It was just in Denmark. He was a refugee who was, I guess, found asylum, granted asylum as a teenager in Copenhagen, and never talked much about his past, his youth in Afghanistan, and how he came to Denmark. And so, but this guy finally, I guess, convinced his friend to tell the story. But the guy is so, it's so raw for him that his agreement was, I don't want anyone to see me tell the story. So it's an animated documentary.
Oh, interesting.
That he actually
like,
animates.
Like Persepolis, right? That was what that was?
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. He literally animates a couple of like actual like interview segments. Like there's an animated version of the director talking to this guy, but that's just like kind of like little benchmarks throughout the movie. Mostly you're seeing his story. You're hearing his voice as he's telling it, but you're seeing the story animated. And yeah, there's something to be said for just a great story. But also, and it, I'm not going to say too much about his story because it's it has all sorts of terrible, but also like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened type of stuff in it. But also, I think it, the movie does a good job of illustrating, no pun intended, the way that not only obviously something like, you know, being separated from your family, maybe some of your family dying, having to move across the country or across the world as a teenager, obviously that leaves scars.
Right.
But also keeping secrets for 20 years leaves scars and alters who you are. Because there's also, it's not just the story, there's also, we learn like who this guy has become. He's become a very successful scholar in the modern day, and he has a boyfriend that he lives with, but they're having trouble in their relationship because he's so secretive and he doesn't know any other way to be. It's really, for a movie that's, you know, to be glib about it, that's a cartoon. It's really heavy shit.
Yeah. Sure.
But, yeah, really, really well done. I liked it. All right. You're up next.
All right. Next.
Unless you want to talk more about Many Saints of Newark.
Let's do it. Let's do a scene by, if we could do almost like a commentary, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Now next for me is Andy Serkis's Venom, Let There Be Carnage. I mostly hated it.
Okay.
I didn't like the first one that much, and it has its defenders. There are people it that like the first one, and there are people that like this one. And that's fine. But yeah, and my reason for liking my reason for not liking it is it's the kind of thing, and I'm sure you've experienced this as well, where it's like, you know, if they just did this a little differently, I could love it. Like I could really embrace it. There is a manic quality to the film that if used differently, I would welcome, because I do think that most superhero movies, I think they are sometimes not just long, but just the way they dwell on things and draw things out. It's almost like they're trying. This is something Zack Snyder does a lot. They're trying so hard to convince you how serious they are. They're like, let's just really spend time on this moment or that moment. This is a lean 90 minutes, and like we jump into scenes, whatever's supposed to happen happens. It's like what you were talking about with the film that must not be named. Yeah. But the idea, it's like, is it, you know, is a certain scene needed in Venom, Let There Be Carnage? Like there is nothing unneeded in it. Like it is, and that includes lines of dialogue, character development. Like it's literally just like, get in, whatever needs to happen so the plot moves forward happens, and then we are out. And in a way that should be refreshing. The problem is that if you're gonna do that, you need to recognize that you are structuring your film differently, and that you can't have your cake and eat it too. If you're not going to allow long moments for us to really understand what a character is going through emotionally, if you're not going to allow that, don't try to do that. And that, I think, is the real problem here. Like, as the film starts, Eddie Brock is living with Venom, the symbiote that is, like, connected to him. And it's meant to be sort of like a odd couple kind of thing, you know, where they're constantly disagreeing and all that. And it's meant to be kind of funny. And it is at times, but A, I don't consider Tom Hardy to be that great at comedy. But also, because he's giving a very odd, mumbly kind of performance, so I can't always understand what he's saying. I know, crazy, right? And they rush through whatever comedy's going to be there. So it's like, okay, I don't have time to laugh if there's something funny. And then there comes this moment where they just fight so much that Venom finally decides, like, you know what, I'm out of here. And so he latches on to another person, and Eddie Brock is finally free, and he can just live his life and just do what he wants to do. And so they have this montage of him getting back to normal. The montage is, I'm going to say, I don't know, 35 seconds long. And then essentially, it's not like Venom comes back immediately, but like trouble shows up again in a different form. And so it's just like, man, like if you, first off, I never got a sense that Eddie was like tortured in a way that he would feel free if Venom was gone. Like you didn't take the, sometimes time is necessary. And sometimes these other aspects from an emotional standpoint is necessary if you want us to care. And for the most part, I just didn't care about any of this, even though there's some good stuff. Woody Harrelson as Carnage is of course great and delightful. I just wish that the film was as invested in him or any of these other characters as they required. I don't know. And then after a while, and this is something we've talked about before, like, I have nothing against CGI, but when it comes right down to it, it's like, all right, Venom versus Carnage, it's Godzilla versus Kong, it's one CGI monster versus another. But the difference is that with Godzilla versus Kong, you got a sense of weight and gravity, whereas here it's just like, it's two blobs fighting each other in basically zero gravity. This doesn't really, I don't care much about this. And it's just, it was such a dissatisfying experience to me.
That's too bad. Yeah, that doesn't sound good to me, but both movies definitely have their defenders. So right. I understand that. Moving on to a movie that I'm thankfully not under embargo for. It seems like for some reason with the pandemic, when everything was like a screener, suddenly everything was under embargo all the time.
Yeah.
You know? And now I guess we're getting back to in-person screenings. I went to this press screening and the embargo rules are starting to make a little bit more sense again. So even though it doesn't come out for a few weeks, I am allowed to talk to you about Radu Jude's Bad Luck Banging or Loony Porn, which is a fantastic movie. It's very funny, but also not something I'm eager to sit through again real soon, because I think it has a provocative bit of, I guess satire is what you would call it, but the things it's satirizing feel, even though I'm not a Romanian, feel very close to home with the way that it's a movie that takes place during the pandemic, though it's not about that, but it, I think in lots of ways kind of is.
Sure.
But not directly about that, because it's a picture, it's a portrait of people who, like I was saying about Dickie Moltisanti, have zero interest in examining their own behavior or changing their own behavior one iota for other people, and yet are immediately keen to tell another person what they're doing wrong and to judge. So the movie, to the extent that there's a story to the movie, there's sort of three, not sort of, it has like very clearly divided into three chapters. The first chapter is a woman going about her day, but with the knowledge, everything is sort of like fraught, because with the knowledge that a home video she made with her husband has ended up on the internet. And so that's like in not a, it's sometimes in the back of her mind, sometimes it's the topic of conversation. She's also a school teacher. So that's what's going on. And the second part of the movie is has nothing to do with story at all. And I don't even really want to go into describing it. It's just sort of like a, I guess it's like a visual comedic visual, like encyclopedia where he brings up like terms that are used in politics or in cultural discussions or whatever, anthropology, you know? And then he has very, shocking like definitions of them.
Sure.
So like, I think the term like aboriginals in the definition is, nuisances that pester the soil of Newfoundland or whatever. Obviously that's not the movie's point of view.
Right.
You understand if you see it, this is all, satirical. And then the third, segment of the movie and the sort of, it's one long scene, one big showpiece scene of this woman. There's been a meeting called, with the other faculty and the parents of her students about what to do about this, this issue. And that's, it's hilarious, but it's also infuriating because like some of the ways that people talk to each other in this meeting, you're like, this isn't that exaggerated at all. You know, we've seen, people, yelling at each other. So sure they're right.
Mm.
And then the bizarre thing about it is because, like I said, it takes place during the pandemic. The whole final scene takes place outside the school. They all have like chairs and desks set up,
yeah.
But they're in like the lawn outside the school, and like everyone's wearing masks, and like the principal will be talking, and her mask will slip down, and you'll hear someone say like nose or whatever, and she like pulls the mask over her nose. It's the energy and the I think the. The motor of this movie, the animating force of this movie, is so immediate and passionate, not kind, like not willing to be forgiving of people. It's, mm-hmm. it's a very like, unadorned, I guess. Man, unembellished. I don't know where my brain is not working tonight. I'm very, very much in favor of this movie. Mm. I will give you, Tyler, the word of warning that I was given to all of us at the press screening, because I know you, care about this sort of thing. The sex tape that they make is real and we see it in the movie, at great length.
Mm.
It's weirdly not the same actress. It's supposed to be the actress, I think.
Okay.
I don't know if Rutter Jude like actually licensed existing amateur porn or hired porn stars
sure,
to make an amateur
sure.
porn, but it's supposed to be her, but it's not her, but it is. Yeah. The movie opens with a extended, like actual bit of loony pornography, I guess. so that is definitely a warning to people who,
one question that I have along those lines, because it's, you know, it's supposed to be like this husband and wife, and you get the impression, I get the impression this is something that they don't do very often. So I imagine it's like poorly shot, and all of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's my first one. My second one. Okay. All right.
Oh boy. What a shift in mood.
Because this movie is terrible and I'm so bummed because this is like the fates coming back to bite me. This is like, I tempted fate is what happened. That's what I'm looking for. My brain doesn't work. Earlier this year, I watched a movie called Casanova Last Glove that I hated.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked about how much I have liked the films of Benoit Jacquot, so much. No, it's like, I remember saying on the movie journal, like, he made a bad one. I know he's already made another movie since. You know, maybe it'd be better. It's, if anything, it's worse. It's not worse. But it's almost worse in the sense that, like, I hated Casanova Last Love. I was bored to tears by Susanna Andler, is what it's called. And that's that is almost worse to me. Like, sure. I'd rather, if I'm going to spend like an
hour. White hot rage is always more fun than boredom.
Yeah. I'd rather be angry at it than just like, cause it feels like it's 4 hours long. It's based on a play. It doesn't try to pretend it's not based on a play, in which, Charlotte Gainsbourg, an actress that I love, is the, wife of a, fabulously rich man, and she's scoping out a potential vacation home for them to rent for the summer, and so like we see her being like shown the home, and then she like stops and she has multiple visitors come while she's like there, so it's just 2 hours of Charlotte Gainsbourg in a room or on the veranda overlooking the sea, I wish the movie found a way to break out of the rut of just like the sameness, even with like, it has this great view of the ocean. But I think Susanna Endler, the character, she's very depressed, and this is a movie about someone who is depressed. And I think Jacquot unfortunately chooses to illustrate that in the most sort of banal terms imaginable, like, oh, she's depressed, I'm just going to make a boring movie then. Whereas, like, I mean, Lars von Trier made Melancholia, one of the greatest movies ever made about depression. Right. That's not a boring movie at all. You don't have to... A movie about a depressed person doesn't have to be 2 hours of her, like, not wanting to get off the couch and, like, talking in, like, a hushed tone because she's so sad and depressed. Like, it's just so boring.
Yeah, and admittedly, like, depression takes a lot of different forms, but one of the, you know, one interesting thing about it is that there are people who are tremendously depressed and yet can still be very charismatic and to such an extent that people are like, oh, I had no idea, and that sort of thing. And then there are other people that are genuinely, like, can feel very sluggish, don't want to get off the couch. So if that's the film he chose to make, it's like, but there's still a way to make that. I don't know, maybe he's trying to get you to empathize, but at the same time, like, I don't know. It's tough having not seen the film,
but there's no, not that I'm one to get like hung up on or insist on like a traditional three act structure, but there's just no rise and fall in the movie. It's so static.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, you're next.
Okay, so we're into my section of rewatches as a function of classes that I'm teaching. So I'm going to go out of order here because I want to go with what you were talking about with the rise and fall and character arc and stuff like that.
Wish I could do that. Wish I could go out of order.
I know. I'm
too rigid.
For a moment, I just thought like, it's like, oh no, you can't go out of order. And then I thought, why not? Who am I? You?
Yeah,
I do what I want. The only person that tells me what to do is my pastor. Anyway, I rewatched Darius Marder's Sound of Metal to talk about sound in my film aesthetics class. And I haven't seen it since I watched it the first time. And in watching it this time, of course, I still love it. I still adore it. I think it's a beautifully realized film. Obviously, the way that it uses sound, the way that it uses music, is very effective. But also, from a script standpoint, I think it's really, it really works. Like, it's given the nature of the story and the nature of the main character, it just seems so unconventional. And yet, it's a very traditional, character study about this guy who basically has defined himself one way probably is a way to cope with addiction. So it's like, okay, well, that's not me anymore. Now what I am is a musician, and I'm doing, and I'm a boyfriend, and I'm doing very well. And then his hearing is ripped from him. And so it's like, well, now what am I? I'm nothing. And just watching him deal with that, and then watching the natural developments that come from him being part of this deaf community and all that, and then watching him deal with that, and then scamper back to who he was, and really trying, and then realizing he can't actually be that, so he might as well figure out who he's going to be now. And, you know, one thing that I really like, and something that unfortunately doesn't happen as often as I would like, is that there are character studies where your main character, you're always on his side, and he or she doesn't seem to have a lot of flaws. Here, the character makes bad decisions. He can be very thoughtless. And yet I'm always rooting for him. And I think those are those for me are the most effective character studies, where they're far from perfect, and they will often make decisions, you know, when a friend makes a decision, you're like, oh boy, that was a bad call. But that doesn't mean that you look down on the friend or anything like that. You still love them quite a bit. And I feel like we really love the character of Ruben. And so from a structure standpoint, like, again, the peaks and valleys and all that, like, and then him arriving at a very different emotional place than where he started. I think it's a wonderfully realized film, obviously from the sense of form, but also from screenwriting structure and wonderful dialogue as well. It's a film I feel like I can watch over and over again, which is good, because it's probably going to be my official movie to watch when talking about sound in my aesthetics class. I've kind of locked into it now. Just like when talking about color, we watched Do the Right Thing. Partially because I just...
Not Pleasantville?
Yeah, it's... I mean, no, you know...
I think it's a better movie.
Yeah, it is. Every once in a while, Do the Right Thing is one of those things where it's like, well, look, I'm going to find a way to work it in, no matter what. And it's like, okay, the way he uses color, done, I'll take it. But yeah, and so Sound of Metal, I think previously it was Scott Pilgrim or Tremors. Both have a wonderful soundscape, but I think this one, from the standpoint of using sound to create empathy, I think it's right up there.
When I worked at a video store in Chicago, a guy came in, like, an opened account, and his name was Gary Ross. Oh. And I was like, oh, did you direct Pleasantville? And he was like, no. And I was like, I bet you get that all the time. And he's like, no. Like, most people don't know the director of Pleasantville is named Gary Ross.
I interned for Gary Ross, you know.
Oh, I did not know that. All right. Now on to the real... kickoff of horror movies in October for me, at least ones I haven't seen before that I'm so glad I've seen. I'm going to bet you've seen this.
Okay.
Stan Winston's Pumpkinhead.
It's been a very long time. And I remember the monster. I remember the basic story. But I don't have super specific memory.
I didn't know the story, and I didn't know, like, obviously I know Stan Winston. I know who he is. He makes monsters, and the monster effects in here are awesome.
Yeah.
But it's more than that. It's like a good movie. You've got Lance Henriksen in the lead role. So, already you're on the right path. He, like, it's this sort of, I guess it's supposed to be like Appalachia or whatever.
Yeah, I think so.
I think one of the people I was watching it with was like, I'm pretty sure that's Topanga Canyon. it's supposed to be Appalachia.
Yeah.
Some city folk cause an accident that hurts his son. And so he goes into the deep woods to find a witch to, like, set Pumpkinhead loose on these city folks. But the movie is not, like, gleeful about that. It has fun with the monster doing, like, being a monster and, like, killing people in fun ways. The guy gets impaled on a rifle, and then, like, Pumpkinhead, like, lifts the rifle up. So there's, like, because Pumpkinhead's huge.
Yes.
So, like, there's a guy, you know, impaled on a rifle, being hoisted in midair. It's pretty cool looking. So there's, like, fun stuff like that. But the, like, the movie is actually taking this idea of like grief and vengeance kind of seriously. And Lance Very Anderson much so, is yeah. like tortured about the loss of his son, but also about what he's wrought mm-hmm. at the same time. It's not what I expected about, I was like, oh, it's going to be like a fun, like monster movie about, a monster that has a head like a pumpkin, which it is, but, surprisingly like richly shot. It was the, I watched it at a friend's house and friend of the show, Frank Feel My Wrath McGrath. Mm-hmm. And he has the Scream Factory Blu-ray. It looks great. Nice. Like rich colors. Also, I wanted to call out, I had to look up her name. Peggy Walton Walker plays the old witch mm-hmm. and she's so great. There's a certain kind of like hamming it up that is just right on point for a certain type of movie. And she's doing like, she's an old witch, but she's like an Appalachian witch. So she's got a Southern accent and like, yeah. It's so great. I loved every moment that she was on screen.
I should explain my weird hesitance to talk about whether I'd seen the movie or not. I saw again many years ago and had very little memory for it, but it does feature pretty heavily into the documentary that I just made. So I watched a lot of scenes.
Oh, okay.
But not the film in its entirety. So I and of course my first thought was like, I gotta watch this all the way through again, because some of the stuff that I watch is like, oh yeah, like these city folk, they're careless and reckless,
and
but they're
one
not
of them is a dick.
One of the, yes.
Yeah.
But they're not heartless yeah. at all. Many of them feel horrible about what has happened.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so like, you can't even really feel that gleeful.
Yeah. It's not the thing of just like, let's just have a bunch of dumb teens
yeah.
or dumb college kids that we can enjoy watching get picked off.
Yeah.
No, there's one of them that is a bad guy, but yeah. like the rest of them are, yeah, you don't want to see them get sad when they get killed, but also it's kind of cool.
Yeah, and it's a good looking movie as well. I think the visual quality to it is really interesting. But yeah, I should watch it for real.
And then I'm up next. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Oh man, another brand new movie that I just saw last night, so I'm not sure my thoughts on it are fully formed yet, but I loved it. Mia Hansen Loves Bergman Island.
Okay.
Is a movie that takes place on the island in Sweden where Ingmar Bergman lived and where he made many of his movies. Mm-hmm. And the film takes those into, you know, you can recognize certain buildings, and they talk about like, oh, this is where the jetty was, and through a glass darkly. Like, the movie is talking about Bergman all the time, but it's also about a couple who are both filmmakers, played by Tim Roth and Vicky Creeps, who are both working on screenplays of their own and are kind of using this as like an artist retreat. They have a daughter together, but she's like with grandma for like the week, and they're just gonna like stay here and like work on their thing, but also like tour the island because they're both Bergman fans or whatever. So it's a fun movie for Bergman fans. And I know there are bigger Bergman fans than I am, but I got a kick out of it. But it's also a movie about an artist working in the shadow of other artists. And the idea of like, I mean, right from the beginning, Vicky Creeps is like, why did we choose to do this here? Like I sit down at this desk and I don't feel like I'm worthy because like,
yeah,
Ingmar Bergman wrote here or whatever. But also the movie itself is not entirely, the movie itself is about their fandom, and other people that come and go in the movie are fans of Bergman, but also some of them are not. And the movie is, not like, the movie itself is not fanish about, Ingmar Bergman. I don't think, like I said, a bigger Bergman fan can maybe point this out, but I don't think visually Mia Hansen Love changes her style that much. Like, it doesn't feel like Bergman. It still feels like a Mia Hansen Love movie,
right?
Or at least I should say it looks like a Mia Hansen Love movie. It does feel like Bergman in the way that I've come to love him, in that people talk about Bergman, and even within this movie, people talk about Bergman in terms of like, he was haunted and existential, and like there's no catharsis for his characters, and like there's a lot of that in his movies, but also there's a great deal of attention paid in his movies to like physical humanity, tangible physical humanity, and the like tactile just pleasures or displeasures of life. And Mia Hansen Love, definitely the movie might not look like Bergman, but it felt like that. It felt like this, there would be these people going through some psychological turmoils, but they're also just like living and like having sex, and like there's, it's the summer and they're on the beach and it's like awesome and beautiful, and the movie doesn't try to like make it feel all like cold. But there's a reference of Vicky Creeps is like, how could he have made such sad movies? This place is so beautiful. And Tim Roth is like, well, I wonder what it's like in fucking January. And then I've talked about the movie in general. The story goes in different places that are really fascinating and surprising at certain points. There's also I don't know. There's another actress in the movie that I didn't know was in the movie, but I think that's because I don't pay attention, so I don't know if it's supposed to be. But one of my favorite actresses currently working is Mia Wasikowska, and she shows up in the movie for what ends up being a pretty large part as it goes on. And so, Vicky Creeps, Tim Roth, and Mia Wasikowska. That's a fantastic three-legged table right there.
Quite as good as a four-legged.
There is actually a fourth leg. His name is Anders Danielsson Lee, and he's actually really good too. For some reason, he's in Personal Shopper, but I know him most from Paul Greengrass's 22 July, which is not a good
movie. Right.
All right, your turn, and then I've got one more.
Real quick, I will say, and this is so stupid, but it's the first place my mind went. Because I got an email about Bergman Island to review it. And I assumed it was in some way about Ingmar Bergman, but like Bergman Island, my first thought was like, is that like a dour reality show? I just thought of like, you know, like a dating show, but nobody like actually looks at each other when they're talking, and just like this really stereotypical like Bergman thing, shot in black and white, obviously.
Right.
But and nobody ever winds up together, except maybe to be miserable. Anyway, okay. So this is a rewatch for me that I chose for my History of American Cinema class. I'm talking about the mainstream 60s, and we watch John's...
It's a mad world.
You know what? The class is not long enough. John Sturges's The Magnificent Seven is what I chose to watch, because I wanted to, you know, it's History of American Cinema, and so I want to try and work in like American genres, and we certainly did as far as film noir, but I wanted to get a Western in there, and I thought like, well, what
are you doing, a musical?
I used to with this class, essentially it was Singing in the Rain. Mm-hmm. But this time, honestly, I made a call based on my students, and it's like, I think they'll like this more.
Okay.
And we had briefly talked about, even though you can't, I feel like you can't teach an American film history class without touching on other cultures as well. So of course I talk about Kurosawa, because he's influenced by American pop culture, and then he goes on to influence it. And so we watch a scene from Seven Samurai, and then we watch this, and that scene is definitely mimicked in this movie, or whatever you want to say, recreated. Have you seen The Magnificent Seven from 1960?
I mean, I saw the Antoine Fuqua one.
Oh, you got it.
which I didn't hate, by the way.
It's not bad. Yeah. And this one, it just... I don't think I've seen it. I saw it many years ago, and then this is the first time I've seen it since watching Seven Samurai. And one thing that I admire about it is how patient it is. It's not nearly as long as Seven Samurai, but it like really takes its time, like assembling this team and getting them accustomed to like the little village and all of that. It really is. I mean, the Western is a fairly patient genre anyway, but, but you would kind of feel like, all right, let's hurry up and get to it. Let's get this group together and show and watch their dynamic and stuff. No, it really does go just like one by one, getting a sense of who they all are, what they bring to the group. And I really like that. And Elmer Bernstein's score is, of course, wonderful and inspiring and heroic and all of that, which I think is interesting because the film does adopt a bit of a melancholy tone. And so to have it shot in this beautiful scope and then have this really inspiring, heroic music to only to end, you know, essentially on the same tone as Seven Samurai, which is a little bit elegiac, I guess, is there's something kind of admirable about that, that John Sturges would be willing to do that. Yeah, it's, I think you would really love it. It does feature
on my long list of blind spots.
It does feature, Eli Wallach as our villain. He is not for the first time, playing a Mexican. You know, it's, I really feel like Eli Wallach was the John Turturro of his day, where it's just like, we need, who's somebody that can play a variety of ethnicities, somewhat believably. Get Wallach. And he does a fine job with it. I don't feel like he's playing the character as a stereotype. In fact, they develop his character as much as the character can be developed. And he's often quite funny, as Eli Wallach often was. Yeah, great cast all around, now that I think about it. It's Yul Brynner and Steve McQueen and James Coburn, Charles Bronson, Robert Vaughn. Like, good cast all around, and just a really solid movie.
Last movie for me, last movie of the journal, is a movie that, Tyler, I think you'd really like. A documentary from 1992 that's been restored. Robert Muggy's Deep Blues.
Okay.
And it's about Mississippi blues.
Oh, nice.
Starts at the north and works its way down. But it's less, for 1982, it's less about the history. We get some history. We get some talk about Robert Johnson and stuff. But it's almost a way of, the movie is saying, like, this is still going on. Like, this way of life is still happening. And so we're seeing, it's the best kind of music documentary in that everyone we meet plays at least one full song.
Nice.
Sometimes just for the crew, like, you know, just plays on in the living room or on a front porch. Sometimes you get an entire live performance at a juke joint. We get the guy, his name's Robert Palmer, not the Addicted to Love guy.
I'm out.
He's a music writer who's from Mississippi. And he is our guide, and he's fantastic to listen to. He's a great writer, clearly wrote his own dialogue. And he has a Southern accent that talks, he sounds like, I don't know how well you know the Drive-By Truckers, but he sounds like Patterson Hood, who's okay. From Alabama, not Mississippi, but he has that same kind of talk where it's like, if I tried to do it, it would sound like I was like making fun of a Southern accent, sure, or doing a bad one, but it's like, it's very natural coming out of his mouth. It is, I guess, in retrospect, weird that it's him and then like Dave Stewart from the Eurythmics, the British guy. Mm-hmm. So it's like this dorky white guy and this like British guy with a very like early 90s, groomed beard. Two white guys like walking through Mississippi and asking black people to play music for them. It's like, it's a weird optic now, but
just throwing money at them.
Yeah, but but the music is fantastic. And so I mentioned playing on a front porch. The guy who plays on the front porch, the one musician that I knew, was already aware of, that we see, is R.L. Burnside.
Mm.
And the reason I know him is because he had sort of a resurgence in the 90s. He made this album called Ass Pocket Full of Whiskey, or right, Ass Pocket of Whiskey. I can't remember if the word full is in there, where the John Spencer Blues Explosion were his backing band. Mm. That's like, and so I'm like, after I watched the movie, I'm like looking on Wikipedia and I realized like, oh, this movie, Deep Blues, is why that happened. Like, oh, this is how John Spencer came to know about R.L. Burnside, became friends with him, wrote music with him, and made the album that I listened to in high school.
Hmm.
So I guess it already had a legacy, but now you can see it all restored.
Yeah, that does interest me. Despite being, I'd say, aggressively white, I am a big fan of Delta Blues, specifically.
Well, I feel like in the present day, like, most Delta Blues fans now are white guys like us.
And what's interesting is that, like, despite, I mean, you know, we lived in Chicago, which there is a specific kind of blues that came out of Chicago that I don't love. I don't really like the over electrified kind of blues. I tend to like stuff that's a little bit more stripped down, and that's what you get from sort of Delta Blues. And so, like, I remember there was a time when I listened to it a lot, and now all I want to do is listen to it again, like Mississippi Sheiks and Sun House and stuff like that. But anyway, okay, my last film is Ramon Menendez's, it's always tough when something ends with a Z, Stand and Deliver, which is a film that I saw many years ago for the first time. Showed it in a class last year, and it went over pretty well with the students. So I'm teaching a diversity in cinema class, and so we're talking about...
I've never seen this movie. This has LDP in it?
That's correct, yes.
All right. I'm a big LDP guy.
Oh, you'd love it then, because he's really good in it. I think of him as a good actor, but his character is, man, in the hands of a lesser actor, it's like, ugh, I'm not buying this character one bit. But, you know, he does a great job, and obviously also EJO is in it. He's the lead character. He's nominated for an Oscar for it. And it's the true story of this Bolivian immigrant who worked for a computer company and then decided he wanted to be a teacher. And he was going to teach computer technology at this high school, but he shows up and they're like, the computers didn't come in. Can you teach math? And he's like, okay. So he does that. And he just is a very specific kind of teacher, and that, like, he pushes and does not, and he believes more in the students than they believe in themselves. It's a very classic formula, but it works really well. And I think one thing that they do, I was reading Roger Ebert's review of it, and it wasn't necessarily a very positive review. And the thing he didn't like is the exact thing I do like, which is seeing sort of the students' home lives. And each one has sort of a different situation that is often unfortunate, having to take care of relatives, not being in a good financial position, stuff like that. And it helps you to understand them a little bit, but also there are moments where the teacher he's this no nonsense guy. It's like, hey, you got to be here on time. You got to do this, this, and this. And like sometimes, like there's a scene where a character is at the hospital with his grandma he's basically taking care of, and the hospital takes forever and he's late to class. Mm-hmm. And the teacher we're on board with him, he's not taking any excuses. And like when this guy is trying to say like, this is what was going on, and he just like is dismissive. Like he occasionally goes a little bit too far with sort of his shtick or his patter or whatever you want to say, and is often a little insensitive. And that's something that I really like, is that like, he is our main character and we are sympathetic to him and what he's doing and how he does it. But even the film realizes like there's, you know, it's not just that, like, these are punk kids that have never been talked to seriously. It's like, yeah, some of them are a little rough around the edges, but like, they've got their stories and they've got their lives outside of this class. And it's a really solid film. And one thing that got me was that the director, Ramon Menendez, he's only made like five or six things. Like, he stopped, he wrote a little bit longer than he directed, but... And I don't know why he did not die. I think maybe he just got tired of the industry or whatever. I don't know, but it's unfortunate.
Did Stand and Deliver, like, do well?
Yeah, it was an independent film. It won the Indie Spirit Award for Best Picture. Edward James Olmos was nominated for Best Actor. The film is in the National Film Registry. It's it is a very well respected film, and it made, you know, made like $20 million on a $1 million budget. $20 million isn't that much, but it's 19 more than one. And so I learned that because of the film. It's a math.
Oh, it's math. Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, it's definitely worth seeing. It is, it's everything that you expect from like an inspiring teacher movie. So it is going to have scenes that are a little bit cheesy. It is going to have things that are a little predictable, but within that, I think it's a really excellent version of it.